This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Everybody knows ExxonMobil and all the big fossil fuel companies, and maybe Saudi Arabia, they're to blame for heating up the world. We know that as we drive around in gas cars and we buy stuff for our homes made out of petrol plastics. Can you and I actually make a difference? Not pretending to be green and virtue signaling, but can we actually help save a livable planet? Enter Lloyd Alter with his new book, Living the 1.5 Degree Lifestyle. Lloyd is an architect. He became a successful Canadian real estate developer, but then dropped out, kind of, to become a well-known green writer in a raft of publications that I've seen, especially full-time with Tree Hugger. Lloyd is plugged in. He has good data, and he's not pretending to be green. Lloyd Alter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why should any of us bother to give things up when the big system keeps running on fossil fuels anyway?
Well, I always come down to one simple statement. We're buying what they're selling. We only had to see what happened in the pandemic when we stopped buying what they were selling, that coal companies went bankrupt, airlines almost went bankrupt, emissions dropped by about 7.8%. A lot of companies had to get total bailouts. It's simple, straightforward economics, supply and demand. So if we stop buying what they're selling, if we buy less of what they are selling, then there is less carbon going into the atmosphere. And I think it's really that simple and straightforward.
But, you know, Dr. Michael Mann, who I really respect, says that it's kind of a fossil fuel company thing to push responsibility down to individuals. And in your book, you quote a 2009 study saying 72% of greenhouse gas emissions are related to household consumption. But our recent guest, Megan Seibert, told us industry accounts for one-third of all emissions. Why doesn't industry even show up in the numbers of your spreadsheet?
Well, because it does, actually. Industry is making the stuff. Every time I buy a Haier air conditioner, it's made in China. It's shipped over here. The emissions don't count against me in Canada because it's made in China, and we've exported those emissions. But industry there and industry in Canada are seriously part of our footprint. If you look at the so-called 17 tons of carbon that everybody Canadian puts out and compares it to the 4 tons that a person in France does, that's primarily because we have oil sands and they don't. So, you know, industry is in everything that we buy, everything that we do, every decision that we make. We're buying what they're making it with energy, and we are consuming it. So that study that said that 72% came to lifestyle decisions, that's us deciding we're going to buy a car, deciding we're going to fill it with gas, deciding we're going to live in the suburbs. We make the decisions that ultimately determine what our carbon footprints are.
Good enough. Let's look to the origins of your work. How does your new book build on the work of Rosalind Reedhead in the UK?
Well, Rosalind, I discovered by chance, was this woman who was is an activist. She was running for mayor, and she read this report out of Aalto University in Finland that was titled The 1.5 Degree Lifestyle. And they looked at the way people lived in 6 different countries around the world and their diet and their living and everything else to see where their carbon footprints came from. And she decided she was going to live a 1.5 degree lifestyle for the year 2050, where we all have to theoretically have an average carbon footprint of 0.7 tons. She picked 1 ton of carbon per year. And the whole IPCC report talks about how we've got to have a continual declining carbon budget, amount of carbon that's used every year. I picked the number for 2030, which is 2.5 tons of carbon, because 1 ton of carbon is almost impossible. It's almost like background noise. Doing anything almost gets you to one ton of carbon. 2.5 tons of carbon in my particular living situation was actually close to possible to do without killing yourself. If I lived in the suburbs, if I had had to drive to work, it would have been another story altogether. But this is all fundamental decisions that we make. Am I going to live in an apartment or am I going to live in a house? Am I going to drive a car or am I going to ride a bike? Am I going to eat red meat or am I going to make chicken? If you make these choices, it doesn't mean I can't do anything. It just means you have to make different choices.
Energy efficiency is promoted endlessly as a solution to cutting emissions, but we know about the Jevons paradox, and that suggests anything that becomes more efficient is just used more, which may result in more emissions. Your thoughts?
Well, every time I mention the Jevons paradox, people say you shouldn't do that because it's used by people as an excuse not to make changes in their life, because what's the point? But my favorite example of looking at the change is when there is a really dramatic, radical technological change. For instance, it was the steam engine that caused Stanley Jevons to write his book. Suddenly there was a device that used tons and tons of coal, but it changed the world technologically. The current one that I'd use as an example are LEDs. Everybody thinks, oh, LEDs are marvelous. They've cut by a power of 10, the amount of electricity we use for lighting. And what you see now is almost 10 times as many lights. You go into some living rooms where you could do surgery in the dining room table because there are 50 little LED pot lights on the roof. You see LED billboards, LED-encrusted buildings. They're everywhere. They're getting into everything. I've seen LED-encrusted carpets. And when you add all that up, that's sort of Jevons in action. People find new ways to use the technology that dramatically increases its use.
I would love to go into a store and when I buy something, look at the label and see how many emissions were required just to make this thing and get it to me, but labels never tell us that. Do you think our system purposely makes it hard to know the burden we are laying on the planet with our purchases?
Oh, I think absolutely yes. Unilever is a major European company that's announced that they're going to put carbon footprints on everything that they sell. But it's also really, really hard to calculate. You know, if you want to measure the calories in something, in a food, you can just chemically figure it out. I think you burn it and you can measure it. Whereas if you want to figure out the calories in food, it's incredibly difficult. Where did this come from? Where did that come from? How far did it travel? Was it refrigerated all the way? I tried, as part of my book, I did a chapter where I tried to analyze the carbon footprint of a takeout chicken dinner. And it was wild. It varied all over the map because there were so many variables to take into account. So it's very, very hard.
You mentioned the pandemic and lowering emissions, but now we see that the world is using even more emissions than ever before this past year, despite the pandemic. What do you think we have and have not learned through this pandemic experience when it comes to climate change?
Well, I mean, I was really hoping that the lesson from the pandemic would be that we can actually do this, that we don't have to all go back to driving our cars to the office, that we don't have to fly to all kinds of conventions because we've learned how to use Zoom. And in fact, there seems to be this pent-up demand. I want to get in an airplane and go somewhere. There seems to be all the bosses saying, all right, that sort of worked, even though all these companies made billions of dollars even during the pandemic, but we want you coming back to the office because that's how we like to manage. I said in my book, I was absolutely convinced that I thought that the pandemic was going to mean a sea change in the way that we worked and that 30% to 50% of employees would never go back to the office. And I see I'm already being proven wrong on that. So, you know, I don't know what it takes. The last IPCC report was so scary that I thought that might shock people, and it just, like, dropped under the waves like a stone. And you don't hear very many people talking about these things anymore. I think people are just not yet seeing the crisis in the face, even if they're on the West Coast and they can't breathe because of the smoke.
Yes, I believe that's true. Now, you have been a successful architect and urban developer. Do you see a future of tiny emission cities as possible?
Yes. I mean, if you just look at what's come out of Paris with the whole 15-minute city idea where the mayor of Paris is trying to restructure it so that everything you can get everything that you need roughly within 15 minutes walk. And, you know, it's our cities all used to be like that. I live in Toronto in what was called a streetcar suburb. The streetcar went in 1913, And all of a sudden, now the developers took over the farmland and started putting houses in. But they put the houses on narrow lots because everybody still had to walk to the streetcar. So you didn't get low-density sprawl. And the main street where the streetcar is, there's a lot of traffic there, so there were stores and restaurants and groceries and that. So without even trying, just because of the coincidence of where I bought my home, I never really had to go very far at all. And then the medical system changed where they opened a clinic. I don't even have to go for more than a block to see my doctor. So everything is within reach. And a lot of cities are like that. I was actually interviewed by a reporter from Vancouver who lived in a tiny apartment and didn't have a car and didn't eat meat. And I was saying, well, you know, you're living the 1.5-degree lifestyle, probably around 2.5 to 3 tons of carbon, without even trying, without even knowing you're doing it. Some of these things are structural. You know, if you bought your house, you're stuck with a big problem of carbon there if it has a gas furnace. If you're in Quebec, you don't have a problem at all because it's electric. So it depends where you live. It depends on the circumstances. And it depends on how willing you are to make subtle changes.
You know, I chose to move to a small village in rural BC. It's a walkable village, just like you. It's 2 blocks to my doctor, but it's 2 blocks to the pharmacy, 2 blocks to the grocery store, 2 blocks to everything. But it is pretty hard to get around. You need a car to do some long-distance shopping, to go to Costco once a month, or, you know, there's stuff you can't get here, although online has kind of tended to solve that, online shopping. It's changed rural living.
Yeah, small towns, if this is something that's everybody missed when they say the cities are the places to live to have low carbon, but I absolutely don't agree. You know, cities just export their carbon by all the stuff they buy that comes in these massive trucks. I think small towns, if you actually did the analysis, would probably give you the lowest carbon footprint.
So, Lloyd Alter, what do you think about degrowth?
Well, I was often skeptical of degrowth because I just didn't think it was actually possible and the whole economy was based on growth. And I didn't realize until I read a paper by a fellow in Australia named Samuel Alexander that what I'd been talking about instead for years, what I called sufficiency. That we've already talked about efficiency doesn't work because people just go, if cars get more efficient, they buy an SUV. Sufficiency, radical sufficiency, as I was calling it, was deciding what do you really need? How much do you need? What would be enough for you? And when you look at everything through a lens of sufficiency, you don't decide, oh, cars got more efficient, I want to get a bigger car. You decide, is a bicycle enough for me? Oh, an e-bike, is an e-bike enough for me? You start looking at everything like that. With dryers, you say, well, is a clothesline enough for me? You make changes in your life to find out what is sufficient. Most importantly, like in a house, how much space do you need? And then what I really found is that this is just degrowth in another name. It's just not buying as much stuff, not spending as much stuff. It's about dialing back the economy to what are the necessities instead of the excess luxuries. Doesn't mean you don't have any luxuries, but it means you take what you need. And that when you do that, you find, for instance, if you're not spending $10,000 a year feeding a car in interest payments and gasoline, that you don't need as much money to live on. You don't need as high an income. So that all starts dialing back. So degrowth and sufficiency, I think, are very closely related. The other thing about degrowth is, you know, with the people who don't like degrowth say, well, we want decoupling. The alternative degrowth is decoupling. You separate carbon from your processes. And that's, in fact, the decision you make every day. I've decoupled my transportation because I take my e-bike instead of the Subaru, which I haven't driven in like a year and a half. You know, you can decouple a lot of things in your life just by making different decisions and deciding again what is sufficient. Degrowth, as Jason Hickel's written about it, is that we're all going to have a lovely time not doing big industrial jobs anymore and everybody will be healthier and happier, I think is a bit of a stretch. But I think sufficiency, which is very closely related, we can reach.
You have been a food writer for a green publication among your many hats. What's your number one food recommendation to cut our personal emissions? Do we have to all become vegetarians to save the planet?
Absolutely not. I mean, it would be better if we did. But, you know, vegetarianism isn't necessarily better for the planet. If you say, I'm going to stop eating meat and I'm going to eat a lot of cheese, well, cheese, which a lot of vegetarians eat, has a higher carbon footprint than chicken and pork because it's made from cows. So you're much better off to say, and also if you go vegan and you have a lot of vegetables, like I love tomatoes. So most hothouse tomatoes, because they're cooked in a greenhouse which is fed with natural gas, have a higher carbon footprint than chicken. So you have to, in a sense, become a climatarian, which is a different category where you say less dairy, less red meat, but you can have a bit of chicken, you can have a bit of pork. You don't want a lot because it's still got a higher footprint. And no hothouse tomatoes, no food that's flown in. A local, sustainable diet with a little bit of meat isn't the end of the world and can cut your carbon drastically. The single biggest thing is red meat. Get rid of the steaks. And a lot of the people have been doing that for years anyway. The proportion of red meat is going down in relation to chicken. So, no, I think we'd be much better if we actually looked at the climatarian menu and forgot about that. Well, being vegan would be great, but it's got to be a vegan without the wrong vegetables that are grown in hothouses.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is architect, green journalist, and Ryerson University lecturer Lloyd Alter. We're talking about living the 1.5-degree lifestyle, his new book. So as an architect, do you appreciate the possibilities of this thing called passive house, designed for buildings that use hardly any energy? At least a decade ago, I recorded and then interviewed Austrian architect Guido Wimmers in Vancouver. He helped build Austria House for the 2010 Olympics, which needed no heat, even though it was in a mountain environment. People were skiing into it. No furnace. There are thousands and thousands of net zero kind of passive house of buildings in Europe, not just homes, but schools, office buildings, and apartments. Why is this green building tech almost unknown in North America and hardly built here?
Well, you used two phrases together, net zero and passive house. And the fact is they're very, very different.
I knew you'd catch me on that.
Net zero is very popular in the States. Net zero is sort of the idea that you can have your cake and eat it. You can build your house, you can add a little more insulation, but then you load up solar panels on the roof, and if you generate more power over the year than your house actually uses, then you get to call yourself net zero and feel good about it. The fact is that comes the dead of winter or a long time with no sun and things like that, you're still having to rely on the grid, and the grid has to be sized for those peak times. It's not based on an average. It's got to be there when everybody's using it. And so all that infrastructure, all those sort of in Ontario, for instance, peaker gas plants that only come on when they have to, when there's not enough out of the nukes and out of the water, net zero doesn't mean zero. It just means this balance. The passive house concept, on the other hand, says that we're going to insulate. We're going to build really well. We're going to seal it really tightly. And we're just going to use less. We're going to drive our energy consumption down as far as we can until we're just sipping a little bit of electricity. And then if the power even goes out, these houses are like thermos bottles. They can stay comfortable for a week or two without any heat at all. So it's very important to separate the two concepts. People in North America have not wanted to go for passive house because the builders have to learn how to build more carefully. I think quality control is the most important thing. They have this big red blower door and they pressurize the house. And if it doesn't pass, you've got to find every hole and you've got to patch it. It's really concerned about minimizing the use of energy, whereas net zero is just concerned about balancing it. And it lets people have big windows, and it lets people with all the jogs and gables and the architectural chutzkas that people love to have on houses, instead of saying, let's make a really simple, efficient box and insulate it to death and have great quality windows and be really comfortable in it. It's just a different way of thinking. And in Germany, where it started, it caught on, and in North America, it's just creeping in.
What about heat pumps? Are they a good solution for our carbon footprint reduction?
They are a wonderful solution used in tandem with dramatic reduction of the amount of energy you need. So if you insulate a house really well and toss out the gas furnace and put in a heat pump, you've done a really good thing. What's happening right now with heat pumps is in the States, and there are a couple of really popular and important thinkers who are saying this, is that, and this is something I've always said, energy is not carbon. They're not the same thing, and our problem is reducing the amount of carbon that's going into the atmosphere, and carbon comes from burning fossil fuels. Energy, if it comes from a clean source, and if it goes into a heat pump, doesn't put out any carbon. So this thinking is, just take your house, cover it with solar panels, put in a heat pump, keep adding solar panels until you've got enough to power the heat pump, and you're set. And don't worry about energy efficiency, and don't worry about the washing machine and the electric car and the big windows, because you're burning clean energy and it's not producing any carbon, so heat pumps will save the world. The problem is that heat pumps are like air conditioners that have refrigerants in them that are greenhouse gases. Heat pumps take a lot of metal and a lot of stuff to build, and so do solar panels, and the whole system sort of favors those people who live in big houses with big roofs that can carry big solar arrays. And if you live in an apartment, that's not going to work for you. There's not enough roof. You know, if you live in a tiny house, it's not going to do it for you. So that I keep coming back to the thing saying, yes, heat pumps are wonderful, but only for that last little bit after you've done everything else to reduce your energy demand.
Well, you can't include everything in a book, or it'd be 1,000 pages and nobody would read it. But one thing I do find missing in your new book are emissions from the global military machine. Shouldn't we add a little something to your spreadsheet for the massive emissions that we use for consumer security, let's say, for the corporations that mine, pump, and cut down the resources all over the world so we can bring the loot back to our place?
Well, you know, when we talk about 72% of those emissions are lifestyle, the other 28% of the emissions are supposed to be those ones that are sort of governmental, that theoretically include the military. But I think you're absolutely right in saying that we grossly underestimated. I saw a statistic just the other day that the American military alone was an emitter of more carbon than about 24 countries altogether. It's something that we overlook constantly and shouldn't. They're all running on fossil fuels.
I read your whole book. I learned a lot of good stuff. You give a lot of great sources and leads, as a good journalist should. But judging from the top scientists I interview for this show, I have a little bit of a dispute about your title. I don't think there's a hope in hell of staying below 1.5 degrees C of global warming. Maybe your title should be more like the Save Our Butts lifestyle.
You may well be right. I mean, the new latest IPCC report was both optimistic and saying it could be done, but, you know, we have to do so much to actually save our butt to get there that it's going to be an incredible challenge. And the problem of it is, you know, half the world is living under 2.5 tons a year now. Half the world is living a 1.5 lifestyle now, and they're in energy poverty. You know, they don't have enough heat. They're cooking on wood. But 50% of the emissions are coming from the top 10% of the world's population in terms of wealth. And that's all of us. It's everyone who's listening to this show. We are the people who are making the emissions. And yet everybody's saying, oh, it's China, it's China. But what's China doing? It's making the stuff that we're buying. You're right. It should be the save our butt diet or this lifestyle.
And what do you hope your book is going to do for people, and where can we find out more, Lloyd?
Oh, you can find out more by getting the book, which is available from New Society Publishers. Will be available online in an e-book and an audiobook format. You can read the original 1.5 Lifestyle Report. There's a wonderful new website called hotorcool.org that has been looking at this and updating everything in terms of lifestyle. And I've been actually working with them to produce a monster version of the spreadsheet that I did that the public can use. It's not like a little carbon calculator. You use it like a fitness calculator where you put something in, everything you eat and everything that you do, and so that everybody will be able to do this on their own.
We have been speaking with Canadian architect, university lecturer, green journalist, and author Lloyd Alter. His new book is Living the 1.5 Degree Lifestyle from New Society Publishers. Find links for all of this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Lloyd, it was great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.